Good afternoon. This is Read Me Something You Love. And I'm sitting here with Janina Mathewson in the South Bank, in a sort of a basement area of the South Bank. It's very, very afternoon South Banky. We've got one fellow over there standing in front of a mirror, body popping. And we've got a couple just behind us. You might be able to hear the accordion music doing a bit of tango. It's very South Bank, isn't it?
It's a great way to spend an afternoon, actually, I think, just going to a place and dancing. Why not?
Have you ever taken yourself off somewhere and stood out in a public space and just done your thing dance-wise?
Only if I was being forced to, which happened quite a lot, because I have a history of being in the performing arts, and you do that, but never of my own volition.
Yeah, you've got to have a certain, I don't know, what is it? A certain something.
I think you probably have to be more dedicated than embarrassed.
Okay, that's a nice way of putting it, yeah.
Which we all should strive for, yeah. I think, to be more dedicated than embarrassed.
Yeah, well, I'm feeling, you know, we're being fairly dedicated here this afternoon. We're both sitting here with our e-readers. Mm-hmm. And you're going to, in a moment, dedicatedly read for us some Jane Austen. And it's not the Jane Austen that people would probably be expecting.
What I love about Jane Austen's juvenile writings is that there's no restraint. She's just having a blast. She just lets herself go, and it's so full of life, and it's so joyful and excited, and she's not censoring anything. She's pouring everything out, and it doesn't matter, because the people who are reading it are the people that love her best in the world. And I think that really comes across, even though she's writing about history. And the reason I chose her History of England is that her attitude to history is this deliberate embrace of all the things about history that scare me. Because I used to really love history. Well, I do love history. And I loved it particularly at high school, where you go along to your class, you get told a story, and then you just have to have an opinion about it. So it was pretty much the perfect sort of course for me. And then a few years later, when I went back, after having lived in the world a while, I went back to university and I studied history for fun, and I found it very intimidating, because I suddenly was very aware of the fact that all history is connected to all other history, and you can never know it all. So you can be as opinionated as you like, and you can back it up as strongly as you like, but it will never actually be fully valid, because you can't know everything and you can't understand everything. And that terrified me. I told a lecturer that I was having that feeling, and he just said, yeah, that never goes away. And I just found it very difficult to cope with. But Jane Austen, as obviously a young girl, just embraces that and loves the fact that everything she's saying is totally made up, and its value is to her, and she expects her reader to value it simply because she does. And I love that about it. I think it's brilliant, and it's all that anyone can do. So this is The History of England by a partial, prejudiced and ignorant historian. There will be very few dates in this history. Henry IV ascended the throne of England much to his own satisfaction in the year 1399, after having prevailed on his cousin and predecessor, Richard II, to resign it to him and to retire for the rest of his life to Pomfret Castle, where he happened to be murdered. It is to be supposed that Henry was married, since he had certainly four sons, but it is not in my power to inform the reader who was his wife. Be this as it may, he did not live forever. But falling ill, his son, the Prince of Wales, came and took away the crown, whereupon the king made a long speech, for which I must refer the reader to Shakespeare's plays, and the prince made a still longer. Things being thus settled between them, the king died, and was succeeded by his son Henry, who had previously beat Sir William Gascoigne. This prince, after he succeeded to the throne, grew quite reformed and amiable, forsaking all his dissipated companions, and never thrashing Sir William again. During his reign, Lord Cobham was burnt alive, but I forget what for. His Majesty then turned his thoughts to France, where he went and fought the famous Battle of Agincourt. He afterwards married the King's daughter Catherine, a very agreeable woman by Shakespeare's account. In spite of all this, however, he died and was succeeded by his son, Henry VI. I cannot say much for this monarch since, nor would I if I could, for he was a Lancastrian. I suppose you all know about the wars between him and the Duke of York, who was of the right side. If you do not, you had better read some other history, for I shall not be very diffuse in this, meaning by it only to vent my spleen against and show my hatred to all those people whose parties or principles do not suit with mine, and not to give information. This king married Margaret of Anjou, a woman whose distresses and misfortunes were so great as almost to make me, who hate her, pity her. It was in this reign that Joan of Arc lived and made such a row among the English. They should not have burnt her, but they did. There were several battles between the Yorkists and Lancastrians, in which the former, as they ought, usually conquered. At length, they were entirely overcome. The king was murdered, the queen was sent home, and Edward IV ascended the throne. This monarch was famous only for his beauty and his courage, of which the picture we have here given of him, and his undaunted behaviour in marrying one woman while he was engaged to another, are sufficient proofs. His wife was Elizabeth Woodville, a widow who, poor woman, was afterwards confined in a convent by that monster of iniquity and avarice, Henry VII. One of Edward's mistresses was Jane Shore, who has had a play written about her, but it is a tragedy and therefore not worth reading. Having performed all these noble actions, His Majesty died and was succeeded by his son, Edward V. This unfortunate prince lived so little a while that nobody had him to draw his picture. He was murdered by his uncle's contrivance, whose name was Richard III. The character of this prince has been in general very severely treated by historians, but as he was a York, I am rather inclined to suppose him a very respectable man. It has indeed been confidently asserted that he killed his two nephews and his wife, but it has also been declared that he did not kill his two nephews, which I am inclined to believe true. And if this is the case, it may also be affirmed that he did not kill his wife. Whether innocent or guilty, he did not reign long in peace. For Henry Tudor, Earl of Richmond, as great a villain as ever lived, made a great fuss about getting the crown, and having killed the king at the Battle of Bosworth, he succeeded to it.
Shall we stop there? What for you is the pleasure of reading this succession of Jane Austenized royal folk?
I think she just, it's her pleasure on it that gives me pleasure. I think often history is seen as such a dry thing, and she really grasps the passion of it, and not in a tragic, grandiose way, but just with this youthful appreciation of these great deeds of derring do and these wars and these passions. And I just find that really exciting, that you remember that stories aren't just something that people make up and tell. They are how we live, they are how we exist. And I think having read a story that is true, but obviously filtered through the historians who tell it, and then retelling it with your own life is an amazing thing to be able to do. And I think she's incredible at it. It's just such fun. It's just such fun to read. I read it on the tube and I was just grinning. And I love reading something that makes me look like an idiot in public. It means it's really powerful, I think.
Yeah, I mean, she does, I suppose, as you say, kind of show us how elastic narratives can be, because I'm thinking particularly of Richard III, which most of us probably know from Shakespeare and have quite a clear sense of who Richard III is. And she has decided quite
different.
Stridently that actually, no, she quite likes him.
Yeah.
He's actually quite a good bloke.
Yeah.
And he is a good bloke because she says he's a good bloke. And
we're expected to just believe her.
Yeah.
I love it. And she has this fantastic quote in Northanger Abbey, which is one of, I think, her underrated books. I adore Northanger Abbey. And there's one point where Catherine Morland is talking about how she hates history. And she says, I find it very odd that it should be so very dull, for a great deal of it must be invention. And I think that is kind of the right attitude to take. Because of course history is an invention and it's something that we should learn from, but it's not accurate and it can never be accurate. And she accepts that with this just real life, and I think that it's fantastic. And I think that maybe that's another thing that I love about it, is that it is a family history. This is the story of a family and their enemies, and then the stories of that family. And just because they were running a country doesn't make them any less just normal people, which is...
But is it a family that means anything to you? I mean, this family leaves me completely and utterly... vacant, essentially. And I think this is possibly due to the fact that I didn't actually grow up in England, so I never had that sort of rites of passage primary school experience of having to learn all the kings and the queens and finding out about them. I never had any of that. So these people, I just start reading this and it's kind of just like a kind of, who are these people?
I don't know. I mean, I think I was similar to you. I mean, I studied British history, but very limited, in a very limited field. I think maybe it's because my first sort of introduction to the history of the British throne is probably the story of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, which for me was always just about a girl who fell in love with a king. And I probably was way too young when I first heard it to really understand properly all the sort of politics that was involved, but maybe because that was my first introduction really to history, I do find it very personal, and I do find it the remembrance that they are just people really captivating.
So these, for you, these are people. They're not kind of cardboard cutouts, which she is almost like in a kind of in a puppet theatre. Or a shadow play.
I think it's
moving them across the screen for us.
I think, and I don't. This is one of the things that I love, is because she does it in so few words. But I think you get the idea that they are people to her, and I think they're different people to her than they are to me or to anyone else. Because of course they lived so long ago that we can't really know, and a lot of what our opinions are of them is probably because of Shakespeare, and he was very clearly writing to please the current monarch, so you can't actually rely on that at all.
So, although no time has passed for you, dear listener, we've had to relocate because a whole team of street dancers descended on us, and they were not up for Austin, so. So we're gonna read a bit more. Where are we?
We are up to Henry VII.
Okay.
Henry VII. This monarch, soon after his ascension, married the Princess Elizabeth of York, by which alliance he plainly proved that he thought his own right inferior to hers, though he pretended to the contrary. By this marriage he had two sons and two daughters, the elder of which daughters was married to the King of Scotland and had the happiness of being grandmother to one of the first characters in the world. The youngest, Mary, married first the King of France and secondly the Duke of Suffolk, by whom she had one daughter, afterwards the mother of Lady Jane Grey, who, though inferior to her lovely cousin, the Queen of Scots, was yet an amiable young woman and famous for reading Greek while other people were hunting. His Majesty died and was succeeded by his son, Henry, whose only merit was his not being quite so bad as his daughter, Elizabeth. It would be an affront to my readers were I to suppose that they were not as well acquainted with the particulars of this king's reign as I am myself. I will therefore be saving them the task of reading again what they have read before, and myself the trouble of writing what I do not perfectly recollect, by giving only a slight sketch of the principal events which marked his reign. Among these may be ranked Cardinal Wolsey's telling Father Abbot of Leicester Abbey that he was come to lay his bones among them, the Reformation in religion, and the King's riding through the streets of London with Anna Boleyn. It is, however, but justice and my duty to declare that this amiable woman was entirely innocent of the crimes with which she was accused, and of which her beauty, her elegance, and her sprightliness were sufficient proofs, not to mention her solemn protestations of innocence, the weakness of the charges against her, and the king's character, all of which add some confirmation, though perhaps but slight ones when in comparison with those before alleged in her favour. Though I do not profess giving many dates, yet as I think it proper to give some, and shall of course make choice of those which is most necessary for the reader to know, I think it right to inform him that her letter to the king was dated on the 6th of May. The crimes and cruelties of this prince were too numerous to be mentioned, as this history, I trust, has fully shown. And nothing can be said in his vindication, but that his abolishing religious houses and leaving them to the ruinous depredations of time has been of infinite use to the landscape of England in general, which probably was a principal motive for his doing it, since otherwise why should a man who was of no religion himself be at so much trouble to abolish one which had for ages been established in the kingdom? His Majesty's fifth wife was the Duke of Norfolk's niece, who, though universally acquitted of the crimes for which she was beheaded, has been by many people supposed to have led an abandoned life before her marriage. Of this, however, I have many doubts, since she was a relation of that noble Duke of Norfolk who was so warm in the Queen of Scotland's cause, and who at last fell a victim to it. The King's last wife contrived to survive him, but with difficulty effected it. He was succeeded by his only son, Edward VI. As this prince was only 9 years old at the time of his father's death, he was considered by many people as too young to govern, and the late king happening to be of the same opinion, his mother's brother, the Duke of Somerset, was chosen protector of the realm during his minority. This man was on the whole a very amiable character, and is somewhat of a favourite with me, though I would by no means pretend to affirm that he was equal to those first men, Robert Earl of Essex, Delamere, or Gilpin. He was beheaded, of which he might with reason have been proud had he known that such was the death of Mary, Queen of Scotland, but as it was impossible that he should be conscious of what had never happened, it does not appear that he felt particularly delighted with the manner of it. After his decease, the Duke of Northumberland had the care of the king and the kingdom, and performed his trust of both so well that the king died and the kingdom was left to his daughter-in-law, the Lady Jane Grey, who has already been mentioned as reading Greek. Whether she really understood that language, or whether such a study proceeded only from an excess of vanity, for which I believe she was always rather remarkable, is uncertain. Whatever might be the cause, she preserved the same appearance of knowledge and contempt of what was generally esteemed pleasure during the whole of her life, for she declared herself displeased with being appointed queen, and while conducting to the scaffold, she wrote a sentence in Latin and another in Greek on seeing the dead body of her husband accidentally passing that way.
This was written hundreds of years ago, but there are certain lines that I feel like I could have almost have read them on the internet in one of those satirical, arch, hipster websites, things like The Onion or McSweeney's yesterday. I mean, I'm thinking of something like, you know, the line, while conducting to the scaffold, she wrote a sentence in Latin and another in Greek on seeing the dead body of her husband and accidentally passing that way. I mean, there's a very kind of modern archness to that, like a sort of surreal almost archness.
Do you think that's maybe a tribute to the influence that Austen's had upon the way that we write? I mean, she was, you know, she was one of the, I guess, well, she was big on irony. And that's what all of those websites are about, I suppose. And that is why she endures. It's more, I mean, her stories are captivating and fantastic, but it's the way that she tells them and the spirit that's within them that I think that we still love, and I think that maybe why that's why.
So the spirit, that ironic, lampooning spirit, is there's something timeless about that? There's something we recognise?
I think so. Well, not, I don't know if it's timeless necessarily, but it's definitely still relevant to our current modern day sensibilities. It's one of the things that I cherish in people that I know, is the ability to recognise when things shouldn't be taken seriously and to have a joy in that. And I think Jane Austen was very good at that. Which is probably one of the reasons why I love her.
It's presented to us as juvenilia, and I suppose often we see Juvenilia as not having the depth of later work. And this doesn't, does it? I mean, it doesn't have much depth to it.
Well, no, it doesn't. But I think that in this case, that is actually deliberate. And obviously it was written when she was young, but I think she's made the clear choice that this is to be more fun than informative. Which isn't to say that she couldn't have been informative at that point in her life. I mean, clearly, I mean, we all analyse things totally differently at different stages of our lives, so perhaps different parts would have been important to her later on.
You're right, in some sense, you do get the feeling that she's sort of writing this for the pleasure of it, and also in a way to express a kind of jovial aggression that you sometimes get behind satire or behind...
Yeah.
This kind of thing, which is quite refreshing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think also, I like to remember that she was writing this for her sister.
So it's like an extended in-joke, in a way.
Exactly. And, I mean, I know when I write to my sister, which I do quite... Well, I haven't in a while. But I love writing handwritten letters and posting them back to New Zealand and knowing that, in a way that you don't get with any other sort of writing. That's a sample of my personality, you know? And I think that's what this is. You know, she's pouring herself onto a piece of paper so that her sister can read it later on and feel that they're together. And, yeah, I think that really comes across. This is an intimate story at the end of the day. You know, she's writing to someone who knows her better than anyone else.
And what do you think what do you find out by osmosis about Jane Austen in reading these lines and the way she puts them together?
Oh, that's a very hard, deep question. I think as someone who knows her books as well as I do, which I've read each of them countless times, I grew up on them, and they are finished products. And you know that she wrote a draft and then she edited it and then she wrote it again, and as all writers do. And that what you end up with is a crafted product. And here, this is very much an uncrafted product. This is her, she wrote this by hand and probably delivered that copy to Cassandra. And so what I love about that is that it gives you the sense of this joy that she had in her work. You know, she just, I feel like every syllable is just alive with this excitement and this fun. And
the excitement of writing, of actually being, of communicating.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. And I think that that's something to be just really celebrated, that this was an act of excitement and fun, and it wasn't studious, it wasn't hard, it just flows. And obviously all writers have moments when it flows and all writers have moments when it's hard, but I think it's really nice to be able to see the unedited version of one of her moments where she was just flying